we're talking about General Motors, and there's something of a history of corporate aloofness by General Motors and involvement in Detroit's affairs.
Well, I may be unfair to General Motors to put it that way, but the reason I do is during the time I was there, I can remember Jerry having meetings, conversations, phone calls, and so forth with men like Walker Sisler from Edison, who was a frequent advisor, Ralph McElhaney from the gas company, Henry Ford himself. But I don't recall anyone from General Motors having that same kind of relationship.
Uh-huh.
And it could be that some of them did, and I just was not aware of it.
Part of the revival of, or the attempted revival of Detroit in the years after the riots were the new center area near General Motors World Headquarters. I didn't happen to be in Detroit at that time, but was that financed by General Motors?
Yes, General Motors did a lot in that area and has continued, I believe, to do a lot to keep that area on the same good level that it has been on since they took that position. But if I'm not mistaken, they did that on their own. That was not something done in connection with the city. General Motors saw it as a need to be done in that area, and with a certain unquestioned amount of civic responsibility, wanted to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And they went in and spent their own money and fixed that area up, and they continue to maintain that area.
Mm-hmm. But that was a... They were acting as loaners in that regard.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not loaners of money, but acting alone, yeah. I know I can be dead wrong on that. That's just my own observation.
Sure.
I certainly don't speak with authority.
There were press reports following the riot that merit some comment, I suppose. I believe it was shortly before the riot broke out. The mayor also began a personal crisis with the announcement of divorce proceedings from his first wife, Mary. The press tried to make a connection between the riot and his own personal crisis to portray him as one who was immersed in despondency following the riots, putting these two factors together. Can you react to that?
Sure. If the press said that, they're sailing in a sea of nonsense. There's absolutely nothing to that. Certainly it was a personal crisis. He felt the divorce situation keenly, but he rarely even spoke of it,
mm-hmm.
other than to his attorney who was representing him at the time, but he just didn't talk much about that to the folks, and he was not at all critical of Mary Helen in that regard. I can recall, and not to go into detail, but one day as I was in his office, we were going over something, and I got up to leave, and he asked me to stay. He said, go close the door. So I went over and closed the door. Came back and sat down, and that was the first and the only time he ever went into this divorce situation. And he spoke at some length about it and how upsetting it was and how badly he felt about all of this and how unfairly he felt it was. And the papers, particularly the news, had run stories that he felt were just totally not only unfair, but invaded an area where it should have been private. And he felt that certain people, Lou Gordon, for example, and to a lesser extent Mary Beck, involved themselves in it to try to make the situation worse than it was.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Helen and Jerry both had certain problems as result of a person being in the public life the way Jerry was. It's tough on a woman to see her husband, or a husband like Margaret Thatcher's husband, how he faced all of it, because they're gone so much, the pressure's on them. Jerry could have been to 10 meetings every night, and he would make one, or maybe he'd make two, which would make eight organizations mad at him because he didn't get to those particular things. And yet he'd have to be out late many times. And Mary Helen, I'm sure, found it difficult with several children to be raised and Jerry gone as much as he was. So it was an unfortunate situation, and it was made more unfortunate by the fact that Gordon was trying to take political advantage of it and set up certain things to make Jerry look bad in relation to the whole thing.
From a personal standpoint, I would imagine that these things couldn't have happened at a worse time. The rather banal phrase, when it rains, it pours, comes to mind here. At the same time, he's going through the personal crisis. The riot poses a civil crisis, a political crisis, a crisis on many levels to him.
I think he was reacting quickly and decisively and trying to overcome the effects of the riot. He didn't sit around and wring his hands on that at all. He gathered community leaders together, black and white, and tried to get a lot of things happening as a result. As I say, we had Strickhart draw up a master plan of what they might do and things of that nature. But at the same time, of course, the domestic situation was there. And as you say, there were just many things hitting at the same time.
Some individuals, you read historical biography, for example, they talk about how they've been strengthened by adversity. The greater the adversity, somehow, the stronger they feel for it, having dealt with it. Others, as we know, don't deal as well with adversity. It gets to be too much for them. And being human beings, they crack a little bit. As one of the mayor's closest advisors and friends, what effects did you see this having on him?
There's no doubt it wore him down and tired him. It was not the same in the last days as it was in the first halcyon days, of course.
In what sense?
Well, I think he grew tired of the constant criticism that he particularly... I keep referring to Gordon, but Gordon put out so much false accusations, Jerry, stuff that you just couldn't be refuting all the time. Kept saying how close he was to the mafia. I think, as I mentioned to you before, it was a common joke among those of us who were there, the appointees, why, if we had such great relationships with the mafia, why couldn't we get any money for it? And we were flat broke all the time and supposedly in the payoff of the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us knew a mafia. We wouldn't know one from a horse. And it was just a constant joke. But here was Gordon on the television saying that, what was it, this particularly prominent mafia, alleged mafia member, I don't know what it was.
Jackalone.
Yeah, one of the Jackalones. Had Jerry's private number to his desk and could call him directly on that. There wasn't any private phone on the desk. The whole thing was just absurd. Every phone went through the secretary. Sure, he had a private phone, but it went to his secretary first, and there was no phone that only he could answer.
Mm-hmm.
She never heard of a call coming in from anybody like that. Just all sorts of things. Constant thing. And I think just this... And so many people believed that, plus all the personal accusations about them. Or accusations about his personal life, I should say, alleging all these things about women, and that used to get him down. Well, he wouldn't even allow a woman to come near him. One would be out, there'd always be a couple of police officers, some security guard, and I remember one of them bringing a woman over to the table to meet Jerry. She said, "You always want to meet the mayor," so he brought her over and introduced her, and Jerry was really upset with him. And then he said, "I don't want any woman being allowed to even come near me. And here you bring this woman over to the table, and that'll start another story." The time that my wife and I were out to do a football game. And by again, if we didn't hear a few days later that he's out with my wife. Football
no
game.
Kidding.
It just was constant. It was bizarre, and it was so unfair. I think That sort of thing began to get to him at the end.
Do these factors, this, what you call certain tiredness of all of this, account for his decision not to run for a third term?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Very much so.
Are you describing a certain burnout on any level?
Well, it wasn't really a burnout because you got to remember that he was ready, willing, and full of zest to run for governor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And also...
Which was my next question. Go ahead.
Also, he very seriously considered running for a third term. He and I had been in New York on some particular thing, and we spent a great deal of time that night talking about planning another campaign for mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt sure he could win, and I felt certain he could. It wouldn't be like the other campaign, but there wasn't anybody out there who was going to beat him. With all due respect to Ed Carey, fine guy and good councilman, and Mary Beck, they were talking about running against him. Neither one of them was going to beat him.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of people who were critical of Jerry at that time, but we took our polls, and our polls showed that there was enough support there regardless that Jerry was going to,
Then why not run?
Well, I think, I described to you when he told me he wasn't going to run. I believe I did. But let me mention that again. Again, sitting in the office, and I asked him some question about what is he going to do that particular weekend, because it was already time to start thinking about mending fences where they had to be mended and going out and campaigning somewhat. And he sat there for a moment, and then he said, "I'll show you what I'm going to do." And he got up. He was sitting behind the desk, and he came around and sat in front of it beside me, and he opened up his diary, scheduled events. And I remember there was a picnic down for the Sunday, and he took a big pencil, a big heavy black pencil, and he drew an X through it and through the next picnic and the next fair. And he said, "Now you know what I'm going to do about running for mayor." He said, "I'm not going to go again." He said, "This is it." Sure, I think he felt at the time somewhat frustrated. He felt that he had provided real leadership. He felt he was a national figure, that he was recognized as an outstanding mayor everywhere but the city of Detroit. And certainly that wasn't true of all people. There's a lot of people knew how good they were, how good he was. But so many people had believed so many of these darn stories. And he'd been hurt by the divorce. The whole thing was so public. He was hurt by that. He felt personally hurt. The riot hurt him because he felt that he had really tried to move the city in the right direction in that area. And he had done a lot. And he felt the riot was uncalled for and unfortunate and tragic and hurt the city badly. All those things bothered him. But no, he wasn't burned out because, as I mentioned, he thought he'd go on and do well in the law practice. So he decided to go into practice. That was going to be his future for a while, but he got into practice and he decided after he got out there a while that he loved politics too much and he'd run for governor. That time that he ran for the Senate, Governor Williams' people were urging Jerry to run for governor, and he just downplayed the idea of running for governor. But when the Senate was no longer beyond his reach and his love of politics was so strong, all of a sudden the governorship seemed to make some sense to him.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we took polls, and it showed he wasn't in good position. Too much damage had been done to his reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt that the polls showed us that he could not win, but he refused to believe them. He felt he could turn that around.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, he became ill during the vice campaign. He suffered the same problem Sophie Williams did in the Senate campaign when he became ill and was out of the picture for a while when they were in the campaign. Jerry had the same thing. I had to have an operation. I was in the hospital, recuperating. It slowed him down. But he was determined to run. And I would have been a good governor, too. Jerry was just, my thing was, obviously I'm totally prejudiced in his favor, but I think he was one of the outstanding political figures this state has ever seen. Not many could match him. He had an ability to win people over. He was one of the most articulate men I've ever seen or heard. He was the kind of a person who always made you aware of his presence, even after he had left office, even after he had been out of office for some time. And he and I would get together every few days for either lunch or dinner. Whenever we'd walk into a place, heads would all turn. They knew Jerry Cavanaugh, and they, whether they liked him or disliked him or what, they all would be aware that he was there. And he walked into a room, you knew he was there.
Some people call that charisma.
He had charisma. He defined the term. He had so many things going for him that are helpful in that way. Not only did he have a ready wit, but he had a fantastic memory. And he hardly ever forgot a name, no matter how obscure the moment of meeting was. And all of these things had to impress people. He was a very impressive man. It was quite a raconteur. You could sit and talk to him for hours, and that was maybe one of his weaknesses. He liked to sit and talk for hours. But he had a lot of ideas. He was not afraid to stand up to anybody. I can remember one time I was with him in Washington, and it was Senator Hruska of Nebraska, if I remember correctly, who began to jump on him for something Jerry had said. I believe it was relative to the Vietnam War. And he read a statement that Jerry had made. And he said something to the effect, he said, "I have absolute proof that this is a statement you made on one occasion." And Jerry stood up and he said, "Senator, you're absolutely incorrect." He said, "That is a statement I have made on at least 10 or 12 occasions." Not one occasion. Nobody ever made him back down.
That seems like the proper note upon which to conclude the interview. Okay. Thank you.
Well, I hope some of...
marks the end of the Joseph Sullivan oral history interview.